Good evening. Hello. I'm Kerry Brower, the acting director and chief curator here at the Hirshhorn. I want to welcome you all here tonight. This is a great turnout, and I know there's a storm on the way or something, so I was thinking, oh no, no one's going to show up tonight, and the place is full, so I'm very, very excited that you're here. I've just been told by Kevin Hull, who helps put these wonderful Meet the Artist programs together, that I needed to tell everybody to turn off their cell phones. And so I was just struggling with mine a second ago. So if you can remember to do that, we'd appreciate it. And I just want to say that it's a very special occasion tonight because we're very, very lucky to have Wageshi Mutu here with us tonight. And I'll introduce her in a second. But we're thrilled that we were able to put this together and have her here to meet you as part of the Meet the Artist series. Before we start, I want to thank the Stephen and Heather Mnuchin Foundation, whose ongoing support makes these Meet the Artists talks possible. In these talks, we really try to bring the most important contemporary artists here to meet with you, to be in dialogue, to talk and present, and then have questions asked afterward. And so we're very pleased that Stephen and Heather Mnuchin continue to support this program. And I also want to thank Henry Thagart for supporting this particular program this evening. It would not have been possible without his help. So thank you very much, Henry. We really appreciate this. And I do want to thank our staff at the museum, too, who don't always get thanked for doing these things. Kevin Hull, who I already mentioned, but in particular, Milena Kalinowska, who runs the education programs at the museum and does a terrific job in putting together all of these Meet the Artist talks. Before we begin tonight, I'd just like to mention a few other programs around the museum. In particular, we're opening up a major exhibition next week. The first day will be February 14th on Valentine's Day. And the project is sort of a special one for us. It's a major exhibition called The Cinema Effect, Illusion, Reality, and the Moving Image. And it's a show that is a little different for us, and actually is different for almost any museum, really, because it's an exhibition that takes place in two parts. And the first part will actually open on February 14th and is called Dreams. And the second part will open in June and is called Realisms. And the exhibition takes a look at the way that the cinema has really permeated our lives today to the point where often we can't tell the difference between what is real and what isn't real, what is truth and what is fiction. And we're going to be taking a look at that through a series of artists' installations who deal with these issues. And it's a survey of film and video, but it's also really a look at the way culture operates in contemporary society. And there will be about 41 artists, I believe, all together, the last I counted, and pretty much each one has an installation. Each one of the exhibitions will fill the second level, the circle on the second level, so it's a fairly major undertaking by the museum. So I hope very much you can come see that exhibition. And in conjunction with that show, the next Meet the Artist will be Tony Orzler, who does these wonderful video works in which he animates these doll-like creatures, and they come to life, and they'll be sort of staggered through the gallery, so you'll see them in the exhibition. So I hope you can come to that. That will be on February 14th, so if you're not doing anything for Valentine's Day, you might decide to wander, and who knows who you'll meet here. I'd like to introduce the artist now. We're very pleased to have Wageshi Mutu with us tonight. She was born in 1972 in Nairobi, Kenya, and she now lives in Brooklyn. She trained as a sculptor and an anthropologist and received an MFA from Yale University. I first started looking at her work when Milena Kalinowska, actually, and I worked on the Kwanju Biennale a few years ago, and she was one of the artists that was represented in that exhibition. And I remember, choosing the works, and we were very excited about the works, but when the works actually arrived and we installed them in the galleries, I was really stunned by these pieces that were just so beautiful, that took images from National Geographic or fashion magazines or from other sources, combined them together, often with painting, and created these wonderful sort of dialogues about culture, about inquiries into symbolism, about sexuality, about perceptions of the female image. And all these things seemed to be working in the work, but the works were also extraordinarily beautiful. And I know we were quite amazed by them in the Kwanju Biennale. Well, not only has she been in the Kwanju Biennale in 2004, but she's also shown at the Tate Modern, at the Whitney Museum, at the Altria branch, and at the Centre Georges Pompidou Center in Paris. And she's more recently been seen at the new museum in a show about collage that's there now, with a major piece that's in that exhibition. She's been part of a number of residency programs, and I think had an individual show, a one-person show, not too long ago at the Miami Art Museum. Her debut show in London was at the Victoria Moreau Gallery not so long ago, and in the Financial Times, they said, and I quote, "Every work here bears the stamp of her personal worldview, confrontational but celebratory, intellectual but sensuous, a significant solo debut." So please join me in welcoming Wagechi Mutu. Thank you.
I'm a little nervous because we had some technical problems, but I want to thank everybody who's here this evening, and especially Henry Faggart for the effort and Milena for arranging this. They've been incredibly gracious and they doted on me very wonderfully, and I didn't quite understand initially when Henry contacted me about this, what the magnitude was. In a way, you have so many things going on, but it occurred to me, in spite of the fact that I don't have a show here in DC right now, how important it is. The community of East Africans who are here is enormous and incredibly important to me, and at this particular point in this country and in Kenya, we're defining what we would like our countries to be like, in very different ways, of course, for the future. So it's a very big privilege to be here at a point when history is shifting in this manner. My partner asked me today, he said, "What are you going to talk about this time?" And I was like, "Myself." But I do try to branch out into and show my influences and, in a way, give basis for the reason why being an artist is such an important endeavor for me, and also the only way I could survive and talk about the things that I talk about. I'm going to start off with a piece that is it's kind of an inspiration piece. It gets me going and warms me up and gives me a sense of sort of magic when I'm sort of lost or trying to figure out how to produce and how to get into my next project. And it's Sun Ra, and it's from a piece called A Joyful Noise. So if you could press play. It's from the 70s. And the sound, please.
Planet Earth can't even be sufficient without the rain. It doesn't produce rain, you know. Sunshine, it doesn't produce the sun. The wind, it doesn't produce the wind. All planet Earth produces is the dead bodies of humanity. That's its only creation. Everything else comes from outer space, from unknown regions. Humanity's life depends upon the unknown. Knowledge is laughable when attributed to a human being.
Mythology, astro timeless immortality, astro thought in mystic sound, astro black of outer space, astro natural, darkness dark, astro reach beyond the stars, out to endless. Astro black cosmo earth, the universe is in my voice, the universe speaks through this song to those of earth and of the world. Listen while you have the chance, find your place among the melody, horizons beam, astro black and cosmo dark, astro black and cosmo dark, astro black and cosmo dark.
So, yes, that's the great Sun Ra. And now I'm going to go to my work, and I'm going to start with an image that dates back to the early 1900s. It's this wonderfully composed group of Kikuyu women, and it's from a book by Routledge and Sons. It's one of those books that talks about, or at least attempts to talk about, African tribes and categorizes them in all manners that often are badly researched and sort of fictitious. But I like this image because these women are composed to look like they're in the process of sort of domestic work. There's a woman grinding flour and the one with a child in her hand and everything, and it's all very posed. The book is called Negro Types, and it has all various other types of people from different parts. No particular rhyme or reason to the way this book was created. It's just Negro types, and in actual fact, they're all from the African continent. And the reason why this book was interesting to me, I found this book early on in my undergraduate studies, and it was one of those books that I realized I held it close to me. It's more tattered now than it was even then because I always carried it around. And the reason is because I felt like I was constantly being compared and spoken of and perhaps perceived in contrast to these images, because this is what, at this stage still in the U.S., the students around me thought Africa was. I'd been to school in Wales, and I'd traveled quite a bit in Europe, but I'd never, and I suppose because I was in a very sort of international student environments, I'd never confronted this sort of very stereotypical definitions that I was getting from my classmates. But the reason I bring that up is not so much as a complaint at this point. It's been a long time since those years, but it's more to discuss where some of these this attempt to create, to mash together and create one image out of many different separate parts came from. This image I love too because it's this wonderful pose, this squatting pose close to the ground is something that I've gravitated to and used and utilized both for its stereotypical implications, but also because it's quite a sensual and feminine pose as such. I initially started off in three dimensions, working to create a whole out of fragmented and also altering material to turn it into something that is either not recognizable from the original material or at the same time suited together in a way that made it quite different from what it originally was. These pillows called fat legs are actually made out of pillows. So I wanted to make these very large erotic pillows that were sort of a play on I guess what I thought was seen as a sort of a very negative read on the female body, but at the same time, depending on where you're from, a very, very sort of erotic and voluptuous female. And I was also encountering the differences in how these differences in not just beauty, but the way the body is perceived from one place to another were affecting me. So I started to make these faux ethnographic pieces that were, friends of mine posed in front of a bedcloth or, you know, sitting on a piece of pink vinyl, completely fabricated with the idea of the ethnographic image, the image that is capturing the authentic African, and I use these various, you know, sort of the squat and textile and pattern to force this notion of the African, the authentic, the other, and in the process also made a lot of wearable sculptures. So the necklaces that you see are all sort of put together for these kinds of shoots. These are skinny arms, and I used, you know, materials that to me seemed and implied instantly this notion of primitivity or African and so forth, to just try and push the discussion into that. But unfortunately, there's this thin line between, you know, laughing with someone and at someone, and if people don't understand the punchline, it's not funny. So this work in a way failed, and so I stopped making it because it not only was it not engaging a discussion, everyone who saw it at that particular point would ask me, was like, is this a skill that you learned from your grandmother? Is this something that you were taught? So it, you know, it became null and void, and I, you know, couldn't have rolled my eyes enough. But I also thought, you know, this is time to figure out a way to translate. And translation has actually been one of the most difficult and interesting parts of my practice. So going back to the Negro Types book, I picked out this image. And I love a lot of the pictures in this book because of the not just the idea of the book and the attempt to look at from above and outside another people, but also the expressions in the images. I think this particular picture is the one of someone who's, you know, quite frustrated, it seems to me. But I also like it because of that very, you know, delicate and but obvious connection between this Darwinian theory of sort of the missing link being from sort of being somewhere in Africa, and the fact that at this particular point the British were not convinced, the British being the colonizers of at least of Kenya, that at that particular point were not convinced that I guess the people they were colonizing were human. So I move into collage mostly for practical reasons, and I say this because I think one of the most important things for me has been to realize that ideas are always there. You can always create in whichever form, and you don't, you know, need a, you know, lavish accoutrements and big resources to create something interesting. I came from a really well you know, this amazing studio in Connecticut with, you know, the video facilities and the shop and so forth, and a critical apparatus around me, now people who are able to discuss your work constantly with you and give you feedback and all of that, and the libraries and the lectures and so forth, to a struggling sort of moment in New York where I realized that I had to reassert my space again. And New York is funny. It's, you know, leave the city and it doesn't retain the space. You have to squeeze your way back in there. And so I got back and I was working in a very small space and I started to make collage. And it was very therapeutic for me. It wasn't something that I saw as sort of serious work. In my mind, I was planning to do installation and continue the video work and everything. So this never was intended to be seen and by a larger public. I mostly picked imagery sort of to work out from that was from magazines. These two images look very similar, and I placed them together because the whole time that this kind of thought was going on, I would look at certain icons and people. And I actually didn't like to reference Josephine Baker too much because I fell into that category of thinking of her simply as a buffoon and as pandering to sort of European standards of what the sort of the exotic noble savage is. But then I started to think about the notion that Josephine Baker was American and that she was dancing in Europe and pretending to be African. And she was being she was engineering and fostering a stereotype that completely captured her audience, that she was able to sort of enter something that was absolutely fictitious. I mean, unless I'm unfamiliar with this, there's not a single community or nation in Africa who wore bananas as a skirt, and this sort of wonderful outfit that she concocted, and her whoever was working with her, is genius in that sense, because it pinpoints those exact expectations that the audience were looking for. So I thought, how interesting is it that one can sort of create a battle with stereotype from within it by actually masquerading inside of it. Now, whether she was as conscious about this or not, I'm not sure, but I know that she wasn't able to do this sort of thing in the United States. And the idea of invention and creating a new persona and coming up with something new for yourself in a different place intrigued me, because as an immigrant, that's one of the things you realize, that you can invent and you can and performativity is a part of your everyday experience. So the pinup series was happening at this time, and again, it wasn't supposed to be seen by a large audience, so I was drawing these watercolors, enjoying the idea of very intimate sort of relationship with water and ink and the translucency and the very simple, very poetic, very intimate aspects of drawing. Were what I was fascinated by. I was cutting really small pieces of, you know, the collage was minimal in a sense. It was the facial features and the embellishments and so forth. But it was probably one of the more honest approaches to these issues of the body and the standards of beauty, but also the misrepresentation of the black female in media, because I say honest because I wasn't over intellectualizing my watercolors. I was just making them and creating these exaggerations and embellishments as I went along. I go back again in a little bit in history, but this is the year, close to the year that I got to the United States. And at that particular point, we still had a dictatorship that was incredibly oppressive and censoring pretty much sitting on everybody's head, but in this particular case, torturing people who had been vocal against the government. The image that you see here is of middle-aged women who protested a particular, after actually many protests, they went out on this particular day and they disrobed, And in the process of disrobing, they created chaos. And in a way, it's seen as a curse. A middle-aged woman at home whose body is not seen as sort of a sexual body in particular ways, in a public way, I guess. And it's also a woman who's seen as someone who's produced children and grandchildren as such. It's a holy body. It's a very beautiful body. It's not a body that's seen as, I guess in this culture, it would be seen as a sort of almost a woman at the end of her sexuality. It's not seen in that way. It's not seen from the negative perspective. Anyway, this woman's body is not supposed to be seen by children who are, you know, anyone who is the age of her children. And these policemen, these riot policemen, are obviously in that age group. Anyway, this curse was released and all chaos broke out. And in some ways it was successful, but it also clicked in me that I realized that there's something about the female body, be it, through believing in it or just in this kind of way, in this manner where it is, or in many ways that it is able to produce life and be resilient to several things. That is, the female body is magical and powerful, and that there is something interesting in using it as a focal point and as a vessel for so many of my ideas. I also have found that there's been many protests in several parts of Africa, including Fela's mother, who was also very active in the neo-colonial movement and was in her own way very feminist at that particular point. They also did a similar disrobing curse against actually what was then the king and the British, but the king at that particular point. And it's happened in India, it's happened in many places, as sort of middle-aged women, mothers of, you know, the prisoners and so forth, using their bodies as a weapon. This is another sort of wonderful fence of women. This is them doing a sit-down. This is another interesting idea, the sort of taking up space, women taking up space in places that they should not be, be it through just by sleeping, sitting, starving themselves, and then therefore creating what is, you know, been one of the most successful protest moments. And also with family members and so forth. There are men in this image, of course. This is one of my collages that I like to look at. It's actually in the door of my studio. And I use it as a segue to buffer into this image here, which is from a moment when I really started to hone into two places and two binaries. You know, this, instead of sort of fixating on the racial binary that I'm sort of, and we are all forced in as black people in this particular nation, in this kind of a country, I wanted to focus on a binary that's more, it is a discussion more of at home discussion, I would say, which is the fiction of the traditional kind of authentic tribal African and the fiction of this hypersexualized and denigrated sort of female black body in media. And I wanted to place these two images together and create a little object that was fascinating to look at, that was in and of itself a new conversation, allowed these two things to live together, but also showed that there is sort of revealed their problematic in that instant. So the postcards in the back, the postcards that are the background, sorry, are images taken from Women of the African Arc, which is a wonderful and incredibly and seriously flawed book, which is done by several, these women have done several books, Africa Adorned and African Ceremonies, and they're sort of the authors of the modern day sort of traditional African. They produced this book, Women of the African Arc, and Women of the Tribes, different nations, micronations of East Africa. So you see women from the coast, Maasai women, Samburu women, women from Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, all of them in these images. And actually Noah's Ark is supposedly buried somewhere in Ethiopia. This is where some of the oldest vestiges of the Judaic religions are to be found. In fact, I think it is the oldest you know, oldest churches, oldest mosques, and so forth. But this area is much larger than it's not one nation, it's not one area, it's many, many different tribes, many nations, many languages, but they're all clumped together in this one book. And so this was sort of an attempt to bring that and these sort of very hyper-sexualized images from pornography. So I remove a certain part of these women that I think is sort of a stereotypical kind of what within the focal point is in this image, and in it you see this sort of conversation between two women. These images are placed in arcs. I call them arcs. I call the arc collection, and they're in pairs. And this is the way I showed the images. So I sort of went back to this artifact display idea in this piece. A great Grace Jones here, and the reason I have her here is just sort of in a way incarnated Josephine Baker in her performances, and she's taken on the stereotype and taken on this notion of the savage and the primitive and turned it into something that not only is incredibly difficult to watch because of how denigrating it is of what the idea of the black female body is, but it's very powerful in the sense that she actually scares her audience. She twists it around, so you find that the audience is the animal more so than she is. I wanted to play with that idea and sort of use skin, altered skin, catsuit wearing sort of posed figures, squatting, really forcing some of these ideas of what this exotic, erotic is. But I also wanted to play with a notion of ethnicity as being something that is identifiable and pure. And in this work, Writing Death in My Sleep, you see this woman, it's not a, I don't know why this image doesn't look that good over here either, but it's she's pale to the point of being albino. It sort of plays with this notion of what that having no color is. And then her features are all sort of cobbled together from different faces. So it's difficult to sort of identify her ethnicity, but at the same time, obviously she's sort of in this fantasy world and it is an image. This is A Shady Promise, a sort of much more recent work made 7 years later in a similar squat, but a far more powerful pose. And I wanted to think of this notion. Again, I'm sort of bridging these conversations and these ideas somehow, and in the process, not so much creating a debate or a back and forth, but a full entire fantasy of what possibly is going on in terms of these conversations. I made a set of work called The Classic Profiles, and I love this image of Grace Jones because she, again, is playing with that thin line between imitation and, you know, the sort of the bamboos, the minstrel, the masked one, and at the same time, because of her fierceness, she's somehow able to pull it off. But I was also fascinated by, at this point, using words to generate the images. So I was thinking about how people are described ethnically and racially by, you know, these sort of words and statements that seem to make no sense. So you say, oh, someone's eyes are, you know, slanted, or someone's nose is too long, or someone's mouth is so full. Like, what is that perfect face that we use to measure which and how far things are off, you know? And being that there are so many faces and nobody looks the same, what is that classic profile? And my, you know, investigation proves that there is no classic profile in a way. So I was enjoying making this this set of work. I was also thinking about things like sort of white teeth and shiny black face, but kind of placing them in a manner that didn't sort of make any sense and didn't. So I used glitter and, you know, again, exaggeration and surgery, like cutting into magazines as opposed to cutting out of them has always been a part of the way I work. And then again, talking about surgery and a sort of medicine and how that plays into, and you know, in you know, pathology and psychopathology and how that plays into sort of the development of the idea of what a people are and how colonization has been so marked by that notion of disease and infection and how surgery and medicine developed in tandem with imperialism. In fact, Dr. Livingston, when he was entering the continent, you know, both for religious reasons and for research and so forth, he was also entering as a scientist. You know, there was this idea that it was both rational and righteous to do what they were doing at that time. So these images are from that particular time. They're from the late 1800s, and they're actually diseases of the female reproductive organ, and I sat around with them for a while. They're very brittle. There's an element of degrade in them. It's almost like their theories that were sorted out at this particular point are crumbling in a way. And I sat with them for a while, not knowing what to do with them because they're so beautifully drawn as illustrations, as textbook drawings. They're fantastic. At a certain point, I started to place material on them, you know, glitter, rabbit fur, the various types of material that I use, some of it that I have very specific, again, you know, reasons that have to do with almost like how I would work with sculpture. So the tape is protective and it's membrane-like and it's shiny and it looks like sort of the skin that's inside the mouth as opposed to outside. So it has this wonderful sort of way of you enter the image almost like you look from inside out. And it's not, they sat around for a while. It's not after a long period of time that it occurred to me that I could actually create something with them that resembled a face, that resembled a character, that resembled these masks that came out of them. This is an ectopic pregnancy, and you can sort of see the little baby on the left side. So there were all these issues with the female body and diseases, and I was fascinated by bringing those two things together. And it's not in a particularly logical or linear manner, but what came out of them was something that was important to me. It's sort of like the third eye is you know, right in between. And there's something about this moment when propriety and manners and Victorianism were so at their height. It was the height of this kind of thinking. The 1800s is also the height of the brutality of imperial insertion in the continent in Africa, which is really where the origin of a lot of the problems that we're experiencing right now are from. And talk about propriety and posture, you know. And again, masks have played a big role in my work. This particular image is of a girl who's being initiated traditionally, and I like this wonderful cake, of chalk and ochre. White is a color of transformation and death, and it's used to sort of guide a person's spirit from one place to another in these kinds of ceremonies. But in a way, it's such a ubiquitous usage of the color, because I think even in Christian and many, many different traditions, white is used, you know, both in confirmation and marriage and so forth. But I like to use that idea to focus the mask is a way to focus the face into something that is both vile and urgent. And this is a young child in Iraq. The work shifts at a certain point. My interest in the female body as a sort of a guiding force in a place where many battles are fought is still alive and is still present at this point. But I think when the war began, and I think right after September 11th especially, I was quite sensitive about what was happening and the possibility that things were going to change tremendously, both for non-Americans living in the U.S. and, of course, for the countries that were being targeted. So this is a very young child. And this is a quote that I found from Albert Camus. And this is really where I start to investigate, well, what is my part in all of this. You know, how complicit and how responsible am I for what is going on over there and for the people who are dying? And it's always easy to say, well, it's their thing, or, you know, we got bombed or we got attacked. And but I am a big believer that in actual fact, we're all connected and that it's all part of our cycle and our legacy somehow. That these things are not isolated and they don't happen in vacuums. This is a little hand combat. It's a small piece of work. And at this point, I've moved. I was working on paper, writing Death in My Sleep, and the two hunting dog girls were made on paper. And the wonderful thing about working on paper with watercolors is, you know, you work small and you sort of get to control the water, and it's all about that ability to either control and let go of the material. At some point, I start to add so much material and water and glue and all these things, and the work becomes more and more emotional and volatile, that the paper starts to behave like its original thing. It starts to behave like a tree. It buckles, it, you know, bruises, it opens, and it, you know. So it became impossible to work on paper, so I started to look for material that had a more objective surface, and I found that mylar, which is synthetic and plastic and very flat in how you use it, while you're using it as it dries, was perfect to place all of these very passionate sort of ideas on. So this is a shift into mylar, and also there's a way that the image kind of floats and sort of bounces off of the surface in a different way from the way it did in paper. This is Praying Mantra, which is very much a development from the smaller works on mylar. And as I'm working with ink, I think one of the things that's in ink and collage and all of this material, one of the things that I'm doing is I use the material to guide me. So the issues are always there. They're always prominent. I, you know, will read the news and then, you know, work in my evening in the studio. So all those things that are agitating and inspiring me are there. But I often let the material and its inability to spread or its abilities to swell up guide me through the making of the work. And that's how I got some of these surfaces that to me look a little bit like a flayed body or the inside of a body as opposed to the external body. This is actually earlier than the work before, but it's a moment when I'm kind of thinking about this these bodies, these things, these people, these human follies, and how they're kind of immersed and in inside of me somehow. And certainly this, you know, and I don't mean to say that in like this is a self-portrait. There probably is aspects of this work that is very much like self-portraiture, but it's these characters are more psychological states, I think. And this piece is called A Naughty Fruit of My Evil Labor. And there's a lot of amputation and mutilation in the work. There's a lot of severing. And I think originally I started it off both as a way of describing cultural amputation, cultural mutilation, the cutting off of people from their history, from their family, from their origins, and so forth. Arachnid Curse is a work that really helped me shift from the picture plane and get back into sort of space, like I was working with space a lot more and environment. And I also came up at a certain point when I was feeling that space and boundaries were again being used as a weapon to further people's fear of each other, as a weapon to kind of enhance this, you know, this xenophobia moment that we're sort of living in this particular country. So Arachnid Curse is this eight-eyed woman. She's sort of a spider, but she's also trapped in her web. And at the same time, she's consuming these bodies. She's got inside of her orifices, her mouth, these female figures. And what happens is it spreads out onto the wall. And although Arachnid curses on a piece of mylar and is flat, the wall becomes this internal, external kind of investigation of the white cube space. The white cube, in a way, starts to become the body. And Erasing Infestation is a work I did in Los Angeles, and it looks like there's marks and sort of elevated areas, but in actual fact these marks are holes. They're depressions. They're sort of hammered out, and the way I would work on this is sort of, it is almost performative and very destructive in a way. I would hammer into the wall to the point where I would get to what I consider to be the bone of, it's not really the bone of the building, but the whatever resisted me. So if it was the 2x4 piece of wood or a piece of steel. And once I got to that, I would stop, and then I would sort of heal the hole with pigment and oil and anything that would bring out this sort of rose wound-like effect. I'm going to go back to that, and in the process, I created this wonderful a constellation, and the constellation itself was from bullet-ridden buildings in war-torn parts of the Middle East. The problem with this, and the idea behind this also, was to prove this sort of notion for myself and for the institution that destruction is easier than repair. So the people who were lucky enough to invite me to do this always had the hardest time kind of bringing the walls back to their perfect white. I never heard, I heard a lot from the efforts. But anyway, this particular piece is also using that idea of contaminating and marking, except I use mold. At the same time that I was creating these holes and these depressions in the wall and wounding the body of the building, I was also marking it with the odor and the sort of rancid smell of wasted wine. And this particular piece is from a show called Cinderella Curse. This piece itself is called Muddy Waters, and I did Muddy Waters in Memphis, and it was on a laundry line. When I reworked the piece in Atlanta, I decided to put it on a big table, and the table is actually built in dimension and in visually to correspond to these tables or these slats that I had seen that basically carried the bodies of the corpses that remained after the massacre in Rwanda. And as you can see, this whole wall, this whole space is entirely infested with these wall wounds. And this is an image from the 1994 massacre in Rwanda. And at the time I was here in the States, and one of the most frightening and remarkably horrific things about this massacre is that it took such a short time, and I think many people have been found to have been slow in reaction, but it is one of the shortest and most horrific massacres, and it's a testament to human capability, but also how far we can go if we put our mind to it. And together with things that I was thinking about when I was working in Texas, I kind of brought these two layers together. And the other thing about working in Texas too that was interesting was that I was in San Antonio, which is South Texas, a very Catholic area. Coincidentally, so is Rwanda. But this Catholicism, this sort of encouraging of the sort of territory and expansion and conversion spreads in very specific ways. And I just thought it was very interesting to think about them together. And to create these regions, these landscapes that were actually installations. Misguided Little Unforgivable Hierarchy is a kind of work that combines this my fascination and love of Makonde art, which is an art form that comes out of Mozambique that is using a tree trunk. A whole entire family mythology can be carved out and created, so all the bodies are interconnected and intertwined. And it was used actually to speak about generations of people and family and so forth. But this piece was also about thinking about this family of, you know, the human evolution, or the discussion on human evolution, sort of the family of human humans that we are all from, obviously. But there's this wonderful way that you tend to see, especially in National Geographic and imagery that talks about evolution, this movement from the ground close to the body, close to the ground, and as it proceeds to evolve, it stands up in erect, and I just wanted the entire figure to have, or the entire composition to have, nothing erect about it except the totemic aspect of it, and then at the top of it is this little monkey that we seem to have turned into. This image I put in here not to be disrespectful or shocked, but it is an image that really has stuck with me because it relates to something that happened in Somalia in 92 or 91 during Black Hawk Down, where the American soldier is dragged through the streets. And this happened in Vietnam, in actual fact. And I just thought how easy we forget in a sort of 30-year period, we'd forgotten that this kind of thing had happened, and it happened again, and will happen again. A head resting moment, a sort of vicious kind of warrior girls are very ambivalent. You know, it's sort of like they're victors, but at the same time, there's also a sense that they've participated in something that is kind of vile. Your story, my curse. Is a diptych, and it sort of deals with this again. The figures start to participate in hierarchies. Figures sit on top of each other for particular reasons, and there's interactions going on. Some figure looks like it produces another. Try dismantling the little empire inside of you is a work where I again expanded onto the wall with these pearl, these little pearl pieces, and also threw at the image these, it's hard to see them, but these little pigment-doused pieces of paper. At the time I was doing two pieces, I'm not sure if both of them, they're not both here, but the two pieces were, one is a sort of a wild horse and one is a tame horse, and I was kind of thinking as of the female, the mare, as an interesting kind of icon to think of the idea of something that works within the institution and without, from without, like either sort of uses the institution as a way to be and to create radical sort of thought, or works in more sort of guerrilla fashion from outside. And this particular one is the more wild of the girls. And so 50 years before, we see that this similar kind of cycle, this waste of humans, this very specific and precise decision to annihilate an ethnicity has obviously taken place in Europe, and it still continues. Exhuming Gluttony, A Lover's Requiem, is a work I did over a year ago, and it's I was thinking about this idea of, well, what is it that goes wrong, and how do we come together, and what do we come together around in order to discuss these things, because each and every person's issue seems more important than the last. So I thought about the table and the idea of the banquet table as a place to discuss things, as a place where family and meetings happen, all kinds of things happen around tables, and resolve is found, but also confrontation and disputes occur. So I created this room that has these corners, these webs, these sort of wasp-like, wasp-looking used moments. It's the room, it's a very interesting moment, this installation, for me, because it's one of those pieces that works because of every single aspect in the room. So the smell with 30 wine bottles leaking upon this table, this sort of multi-legged table, this table that has so much support but none really, and it's hard to see from here, but actually Very few of the legs are touching the ground, so the table is supported only by six legs. And I move very quickly to this video work that I did, and it's actually sort of the direction that some of the work has gone into, not necessarily leaving out the collage, but when I was in San Antonio again, it was actually during the last election, and I remember being incredibly frightened about going to Texas at that point, because I thought, you know, somehow I was going to stand out and people would know that I was liberal and democratic, you know. Not, I can't vote, but I'm on that end of things. And by the way, everybody, please vote. For us who can't vote, please vote. But I remember worrying about being there and trying very hard to make work in this space. This space that we are given here, this gallery, is also the studio, but it's a very public space. So the administrators in the space are walking through. They're always little tours and everything. So it's very difficult to ponder on collage and to flip through books and to sit around and read. So I started thinking about the space as sort of an entrapment, you know, and a sort of, and also I was fascinated with everything that I was reading about Texas. I was reading about the history, the statistics, the demographics, how many people from Mexico live in Texas, how many Mexicans are Texans, and so forth, and execution rates in Texas, the wealth in Texas. All of these things are astounding. It's one of those incredibly fascinating, huge, huge, huge states. It's like a big, it's like a country. It's so big. But this particular part of Texas made me think about battles for resources and land, because it is next to so many rural areas. And I went out to Presidio and meditated in this area that I knew I would create this video, and that's what I'm going to end with here. So it's called Cutting, and Cutting is really the piece that actually helped me understand and decide for myself that it's very easy to be on one or the other side of the weapon, and you sort of have to make the decision. And I feel like the easiest way, and bring down the volume because it's really, it's kind of a loud piece. One of the easiest way I feel of sort of understanding which side you want to be on is to try and consider yourself from the opposite end. So for example, what would it be like if you were the person wielding the weapon? As opposed to thinking of yourself as a victim or thinking of them over there, put yourself in that position. So I put myself in the position of the weapon-wielding person, who is also the laborer, who is a woman who's working. And I did this piece. Bring down the volume just a little bit more. Hills in the background, the blue sort of horizon, that's Mexico. So we're right there on the border in a very poor, poor, desolate kind of desert town, very beautiful little sweet town. And in a way, this piece becomes an homage to women laborers, to laborers, to people who work on the land, to people who work close to the land, for whom land is life and death. But it's also the same movement that is used to farm and to dig and to cultivate is the same movement that could be used to destroy and to annihilate and to massacre. And the weapon that is used to create can be used to destroy. And at the end of the day, one hopes that you've spent 8 hours, 14 hours, however many hours, not cutting or shortening someone else's humanity, but sort of enhancing it somehow. This piece happened very coincidentally on this little mountain. We'd collected a lot of wood in it. Nothing was working, the sound kept going off. So finally when we filmed, this is a very short part of it, I was exhausted, but it was perfect because the sun is sort of going down. And I'm not acting exhausted, I'm actually tired from cutting. It's almost done.